Years ago, right in this very room you now occupy, a Mohammedan wonder worker performed four miracles before me. Sri Yukteswar made this surprising statement during his first visit to my new quarters. Immediately after entering Serampore College, I had taken a room in a nearby boarding house, called Panthai. It was an old-fashioned brick mansion, fronting the Ganges. Master, what a coincidence. Are these newly decorated walls really ancient with memories? I looked around my simply furnished room with awakened interest. It is a long story. My guru smiled reminiscently. The name of the fakir was Afzal Khan. He had acquired his extraordinary powers through a chance encounter with a Hindu yogi. Son, I am thirsty, fetch me some water. A dust-covered sannyasi made this request of Afzal one day during his early boyhood in a small village of eastern Bengal. Master, I am a Mohammedan. How could you, a Hindu, accept a drink from my hands? Your truthfulness pleases me, my child. I do not observe the ostracizing rules of ungodly sectarianism. Go, bring me water quickly. Afzal's reverent obedience was rewarded by a loving glance from the yogi. A Mohammedan wonder worker. You possess good karma from former lives, he observed solemnly. I am going to teach you a certain yoga method which will give you command over one of the invisible realms. The great powers that will be yours should be exercised for worthy ends, never employ them selfishly. I perceive, alas, that you have brought over from the past some seeds of destructive tendencies. Do not allow them to sprout by watering them with fresh evil actions. The complexity of your previous karma is such that you must use this life to reconcile your yogic accomplishments with the highest humanitarian goals. After instructing the amazed boy in a complicated technique, the master vanished. Afzal faithfully followed his yoga exercise for 20 years. His miraculous feats began to attract widespread attention. It seems that he was always accompanied by a disembodied spirit whom he called Hazrat. This invisible entity was able to fulfill the fakir's slightest wish. Ignoring his master's warning, Afzal began to misuse his powers. Whatever object he touched and then replaced would soon disappear without a trace. This disconcerting eventuality usually made the Mohammedan an objectionable guest. He visited large jewelry stores in Calcutta from time to time, representing himself as a possible purchaser. Any jewel he handled would vanish shortly after he had left the shop. Afzal was often surrounded by several hundred students, attracted by the hope of learning his secrets. The fakir occasionally invited them to travel with him. At the railway station he would manage to touch roll of tickets. These he would return to the clerk, remarking, I have changed my mind, and won't buy them now. But when he boarded the train with his retinue, Afzal would be in possession of the required tickets. These exploits created an indignant uproar. Bengali jewelers and ticket sellers were succumbing to nervous breakdowns. The police who sought to arrest Afzal found themselves helpless. The fakir could remove incriminating evidence merely by saying, Hazrat, take this away. Sri Yukteswar rose from his seat and walked to the balcony of my room which overlooked the Ganges. I followed him, eager to hear more of the baffling Mohammedan ruffles. This Panthai house formerly belonged to a friend of mine. He became acquainted with Afzal and asked him here. My friend also invited about 20 neighbors, including myself. I was only a youth then, and felt a lively curiosity about the notorious fakir. Master laughed. I took the precaution of not wearing anything valuable. Afzal looked me over inquisitively, then remarked, you have powerful hands. Go downstairs to the garden, get a smooth stone and write your name on it with chalk, then throw the stone as far as possible into the Ganges. I obeyed. As soon as the stone had vanished under distant waves, the Mohammedan addressed me again. Fill a pot with Ganges water near the front of this house. After I had returned with a vessel of water, the fakir cried, Hazrat, put the stone in the pot. The stone appeared at once. I pulled it from the vessel and found my signature as legible as when I had written it. Babu, one of my friends in the room, was wearing a heavy antique gold watch and chain. The fake ear examined them with ominous admiration. Soon they were missing. "Afzal, please return my prized heirloom." Babu was nearly in tears. The Mohammedan was stoically silent for a while, then said, "You have 500 rupees in an iron safe. Bring them to me, and I will tell you where to locate your timepiece." The distraught Babu left immediately for his home. He came back shortly and handed Afzal the required sum. "Go to the little bridge near your house," the fake ear instructed Babu. "Call on Hazrat to give you the watch and chain." Babu rushed away. On his return, he was wearing a smile of relief and no jewelry whatever. "When I commanded Hazrat as directed," he announced, "my watch came tumbling down from the air into my right hand. You may be sure I locked the heirloom in my safe before rejoining the group here." Babu's friends, witnesses of the comic tragedy of the ransom for a watch, were staring with resentment at Afzal. He now spoke placatingly. "Please name any drink you want, Hazrat will produce it." A number asked for milk, others for fruit juices. I was not too much shocked when the unnerved Babu requested whiskey. The Mohammedan gave an order, the obliging Hazrat sent sealed containers sailing down the air and thudding to the floor. Each man found his desired beverage. The promise of the fourth spectacular feat of the day was doubtless gratifying to our host. Afzal offered to supply an instantaneous lunch. "Let us order the most expensive dishes," Babu suggested gloomily. "I want an elaborate meal for my 500 rupees. Everything should be served on gold plates." As soon as each man had expressed his preferences, the fake ear addressed himself to the inexhaustible Hazrat. A great rattle ensued, gold platters filled with intricately prepared curries, hot lukis, and many out-of-season fruits, landed from nowhere at our feet. All the food was delicious. After feasting for an hour, we started to leave the room. A tremendous noise, as though dishes were being piled up, caused us to turn around. Lo! There was no sign of the glittering plates or the remnants of the meal. "Guruji," I interrupted, "if Afzal could easily secure such things as gold dishes, why did he covet the property of others?" The fake ear was not highly developed spiritually, Sri Yukteswar explained. His mastery of a certain yoga technique gave him access to an astral plane where any desire is immediately materialized. Through the agency of an astral being, Hazrat, the Mohammedan could summon the atoms of any object from etheric energy by an act of powerful will. But such astrally produced objects are structurally evanescent, they cannot be long retained. Afzal still yearned for worldly wealth which, though more hardly earned, has a more dependable durability. I laughed. "It too sometimes vanishes most unaccountably." Afzal was not a man of God realization, Master went on. "Miracles of a permanent and beneficial nature are performed by true saints because they have attuned themselves to the omnipotent Creator." Afzal was merely an ordinary man with an extraordinary power of penetrating a subtle realm not usually entered by mortals until death. "I understand now, Guruji. The afterworld appears to have some charming features." Master agreed. "I never saw Afzal after that day. But a few years later Babu came to my home to show me a newspaper account of the Mohammedan's public confession. From it I learned the facts I have just told you about Afzal's early initiation from a Hindu guru. The gist of the latter part of the published document, as recalled by Sri Yukteswar, was as follows: I, Afzal Khan, am writing these words as an act of penance and as a warning to those who seek the possession of miraculous powers. For years I have been misusing the wondrous abilities imparted to me through the grace of God in my master. I became drunk with egotism, feeling that I was beyond the ordinary laws of morality. My day of reckoning finally arrived. Recently I met an old man on a road outside Calcutta. He limped along painfully, carrying a shining object which looked like gold. I addressed him with greed in my heart. I am Afzal Khan, the great fake ear. What have you there? This ball of gold is my sole material wealth, it can be of no interest to a fake ear. I implore you, sir, to heal my limp. I touched the ball and walked away without reply. The old man hobbled after me. He soon raised an outcry, "My gold is gone." As I paid no attention, he suddenly spoke in a stentorian voice that issued oddly from his frail body, "Do you not recognize me?" I stood speechless, aghast at the belated discovery that, a Mohammedan wonder worker, this unimpressive old cripple was none other than the great saint who, long, long ago, had initiated me into yoga. He straightened himself, his body instantly became strong and youthful. "So." My guru's glance was fiery. "I see with my own eyes that you use your powers, not to help suffering humanity, but to prey on it like a common thief. I withdraw your occult gifts, Hazrat is now freed from you. No longer shall you be a terror in Bengal." I called on Hazrat in anguished tones. For the first time, he did not appear to my inner sight. But some dark veil suddenly lifted within me. I saw clearly the blasphemy of my life. "My guru, I thank you for coming to banish my long delusion." I was sobbing at his feet. "I promise to forsake my worldly ambitions. I will retire to the mountains for lonely meditation on God, hoping to atone for my evil past." My master regarded me with silent compassion. "I feel your sincerity," he said finally. "Because of your earlier years of strict obedience, and because of your present repentance, I will grant you one boon. Your other powers are now gone, but whenever food and clothing are needed, you may still call successfully on Hazrat to supply them. Devote yourself wholeheartedly to divine understanding in the mountain solitudes." My guru then vanished. I was left to my tears and reflections. Farewell, world. I go to seek the forgiveness of the cosmic beloved. Chapter 19. My master, in Calcutta, appears in Serampore. I am often beset by atheistic doubts. Yet a torturing surmise sometimes haunts me. May not untapped soul possibilities exist? Is man not missing his real destiny if he fails to explore them? These remarks of Dajan Babu, my roommate at the Panthar boarding house, were called forth by my invitation that he meet my guru. "Sri Yukteswar will initiate you into Kriya Yoga," I replied. "It calms the dualistic turmoil by a divine inner certainty." That evening Dajan accompanied me to the hermitage. In Master's presence my friend received such spiritual peace that he was soon a constant visitor. The trivial preoccupations of daily life are not enough for man, wisdom too is a native hunger. In Sri Yukteswar's words, Dajan found an incentive to those attempts first painful, then effortlessly liberating to locate a realer self within his bosom than the humiliating ego of a temporary birth, seldom ample enough for the spirit. As Dajan and I were both pursuing the AB course at Serampore College, we got into the habit of walking together to the ashram as soon as classes were over. We would often see Sri Yukteswar standing on his second floor balcony, welcoming our approach with a smile. One afternoon Kanai, a young hermitage resident, met Dajan and me at the door with disappointing news. 194, Master, in Calcutta, appears in Serampore. "Master is not here, he was summoned to Calcutta by an urgent note." The following day I received a postcard from my guru. "I shall leave Calcutta Wednesday morning," he had written. "You and Dajan meet the 9 o'clock train at Serampore station." About 8:30 on Wednesday morning, a telepathic message from Sri Yukteswar flashed insistently to my mind, "I am delayed, don't meet the 9 o'clock train." I conveyed the latest instructions to Dajan, who was already dressed for departure. "You and your intuition." My friend's voice was edged in scorn. "I prefer to trust Master's written word." I shrugged my shoulders and seated myself with quiet finality. Muttering angrily, Dajan made for the door and closed it noisily behind him. As the room was rather dark, I moved nearer to the window overlooking the street. The scant sunlight suddenly increased to an intense brilliancy in which the iron-barred window completely vanished. Against this dazzling background appeared the clearly materialized figure of Sri Yukteswar. Bewildered to the point of shock, I rose from my chair and knelt before him. With my customary gesture of respectful greeting at my guru's feet, I touched his shoes. These were a pair familiar to me, of orange dyed canvas, soled with rope. His ochre swami cloth brushed against me. I distinctly felt not only the texture of his robe, but also the gritty surface of the shoes, and the pressure of his toes within them. Too much astounded to utter a word, I stood up and gazed at him questioningly. I was pleased that you got my telepathic message. Master's voice was calm, entirely normal. I have now finished my business in Calcutta, and shall arrive in Serampore by the 10 o'clock train. As I still stared mutely, Sri Yuktswar went on, "This is not an apparition, but my flesh and blood form. I have been divinely commanded to give you this experience, rare to achieve on earth. Meet me at the station, you and Dajan will see me coming toward you, dressed as I am now. I shall be preceded by a fellow passenger, a little boy carrying a silver jug." My guru placed both hands on my head, with a murmured blessing. As he concluded with the words, "Dablasi," I heard a peculiar rumbling sound. His body began to melt gradually within the piercing light. First his feet and legs vanished, then his torso and head, like a scroll being rolled up. To the very last, I could feel his fingers resting lightly on my hair. The effulgence faded, nothing remained before me but the barred window and a pale stream of sunlight. I remained in a half-stupor of confusion, questioning whether I had not been the victim of a hallucination. A crestfallen Dajan soon entered the room. Master was not on the 9 o'clock train, nor even the 9:30. My friend made his announcement with a slightly apologetic air. "Come then, I know he will arrive at 10 o'clock. I took Dajan's hand and rushed him forcibly along with me, heedless of his protests. In about 10 minutes we entered the station, where the train was already puffing to a halt. The whole train is filled with the light of Master's aura. "He is there," I exclaimed joyfully.
"You dream so?" Dajan laughed mockingly. "Let us wait here." I told my friend details of the way in which our guru would approach us. As I finished my description, Sri Yuktswar came into view, wearing the same clothes I had seen a short time earlier. He walked slowly in the wake of a small lad bearing a silver jug. For a moment a wave of cold fear passed through me, at the unprecedented strangeness of my experience. I felt the materialistic, 20th century world slipping from me. Was I back in the ancient days when Jesus appeared before Peter on the sea? As Sri Yuktswar, a modern yogi Christ, reached the spot where Dajan and I were speechlessly rooted, Master smiled at my friend and remarked, "I sent you a message too, but you were unable to grasp it." Dajan was silent, but glared at me suspiciously. After we had escorted our guru to his hermitage, my friend and I proceeded towards Serampore College. Dajan halted in the street, indignation streaming from his every pore. "So, Master sent me a message. Yet you concealed it. I demand an explanation. Can I help it if your mental mirror oscillates with such restlessness that you cannot register our guru's instructions?" I retorted. The anger vanished from Dajan's face. "I see what you mean," he said ruefully. "But please explain how you could know about the child with the jug." By the time I had finished the story of Master's phenomenal appearance at the boarding house that morning, my friend and I had reached Serampore College. "The account I have just heard of Aguru's powers," Dajan said, "makes me feel that any university in the world is only a kindergarten." Chapter 20. We do not visit Kashmir. "Father, I want to invite Master and 4 friends to accompany me to the Himalayan foothills during my summer vacation. May I have 6 train passes to Kashmir and enough money to cover our travel expenses?" "As I had expected," Father laughed heartily. "This is the 3rd time you have given me the same cock and bull story. Didn't you make a similar request last summer, and the year before that?" "At the last moment, Sri Yuktswarji refuses to go. It is true, Father, I don't know why my guru will not give me his definite word about Kashmir. But if I tell him that I have already secured the passes from you, somehow I think that this time he will consent to make the journey." Father was unconvinced at the moment. But the following day, after some good-humored jibes, he handed me 6 passes and a roll of 10 rupee bills. I hardly think your theoretical trip needs such practical props, he remarked, but here they are. That afternoon, I exhibited my booty to Sri Yukteswar. Though he smiled at my enthusiasm, his words were non-committal. I would like to go, we shall see. He made no comment when I asked his little hermitage disciple, can I, to accompany us. I also invited three other friends, Rajendranath Mitra, Jyotinordi, and one other boy. Our date of departure was set for the following Monday. On Saturday and Sunday I stayed in Calcutta, where marriage rites for a cousin were being celebrated at my family home. I arrived in Serampore with my luggage early Monday morning. Rajendra met me at the hermitage door. Master is out, walking. He has refused to go. I was equally grieved and obdurate. I will not give father a third chance to ridicule my chimerical plans for Kashmir. Come, the rest of us will go anyhow. Rajendra agreed. I left the ashram to find a servant. Can I knew, would not take the trip without master, and someone was needed to look after the luggage. I bethought myself of Bihari, previously a servant in my family home, who was now employed by a Serampore schoolmaster. As I walked along briskly, I met my guru in front of the Christian church near Serampore courthouse. Where are you going? Sri Yukteswar's face was unsmiling. Sir, I hear that you and Kanai will not take the trip we have been planning. I am seeking Bihari. You will recall that last year he was so anxious to see Kashmir that he even offered to serve without pay. I remember. Nevertheless, I don't think Bihari will be willing to go. I was exasperated. He is just eagerly waiting for this opportunity. My guru silently resumed his walk. I soon reached the schoolmaster's house. Bihari, in the courtyard, greeted me with a friendly warmth that abruptly vanished as soon as I mentioned Kashmir. With a murmured word of apology, the servant left me and entered his employer's house. I waited half an hour, nervously assuring myself that Bihari's delay was being caused by preparations for his trip. Finally, I knocked at the front door. Bihari left by the back stairs about 30 minutes ago, a man informed me. A slight smile hovered about his lips. I departed sadly, wondering whether my invitation had been too coercive or whether Master's unseen influence were at work. Passing the Christian church, again I saw my guru walking slowly toward me. Without waiting to hear my report, he exclaimed, "So Bihari would not go. Now, what are your plans?" I felt like a recalcitrant child who is determined to defy his masterful father. Sir, I am going to ask my uncle to lend me his servant, Lal Dari. See your uncle if you want to, Sri Yukteswar replied with a chuckle. But I hardly think you will enjoy the visit. Apprehensive but rebellious, I left my guru and entered Serampore courthouse. My paternal uncle, Sarada Ghosh, a government attorney, welcomed me affectionately. I am leaving today with some friends for Kashmir, I told him. For years I have been looking forward to this Himalayan trip. I am happy for you, Mukunda. Is there anything I can do to make your journey more comfortable? These kind words gave me a lift of encouragement. Dear uncle, I said, could you possibly spare me your servant, Lal Dari? My simple request had the effect of an earthquake. Uncle jumped so violently that his chair overturned. The papers on the desk flew in every direction, and his pipe, a long, coconut-stemmed hubble bubble, fell to the floor with a great clatter. You selfish young man, he shouted, quivering with wrath. What a preposterous idea. Who will look after me? If you take my servant on one of your pleasure jaunts. I concealed my surprise, reflecting that my amiable uncle's sudden change of front was only one more enigma in a day fully devoted to incomprehensibility. My retreat from the courthouse office was more alacritous than dignified. I returned to the hermitage, where my friends were expectantly gathered. Conviction was growing on me that some sufficient if exceedingly recondite motive was behind Master's attitude. Remorse seized me that I had been trying to thwart my guru's will. Mukunda, wouldn't you like to stay a while longer with me? Sri Yukteswar inquired. Rajendra and the others can go ahead now, and wait for you at Calcutta. There will be plenty of time to catch the last evening train leaving Calcutta for Kashmir.
Sir, I don't care to go without you, I said mournfully. My friends paid not the slightest attention to my remark. They summoned a hackney carriage and departed with all the luggage. Kanai and I sat quietly at Agaru's feet. After a half hour of complete silence, Master rose and walked toward the second floor dining patio.
Kanai, please serve Mukunda's food. His train leaves soon. Getting up from my blanket seat, I staggered suddenly with nausea and a ghastly churning sensation in my stomach. The stabbing pain was so intense that I felt I had been abruptly hurled into some violent hell. Groping blindly toward my guru, I collapsed before him, attacked by all symptoms of the dread Asiatic cholera. Sri Yukteswar and Kanai carried me to the sitting room. Racked with agony, I cried, Master, I surrender my life to you, for I believed it was indeed fast ebbing from the shores of my body. Sri Yukteswar put my head on his lap, stroking my forehead with angelic tenderness. You see now what would have happened if you were at the station with your friends, he said. I had to look after you in this strange way, because you chose to doubt my judgment about taking the trip at this particular time. I understood at last. Inasmuch as great masters seldom see fit to display their powers openly, a casual observer of the day's events would have imagined that their sequence was quite natural. My guru's intervention had been too subtle to be suspected. He had worked his will through Bihari and my uncle Sarada and Rajendra and the others in such an inconspicuous manner that probably everyone but myself thought the situations had been logically normal. As Sri Yukteswar never failed to observe his social obligations, he instructed Kanai to go for a specialist, and to notify my uncle. Master, I protested, only you can heal me. I am too far gone for any doctor. Child, you are protected by the divine mercy. Don't worry about the doctor, he will not find you in this state. You are already healed. With my guru's words, the excruciating suffering left me. I sat up feebly. A doctor soon arrived and examined me carefully. You appear to have passed through the worst, he said. I will take some specimens with me for laboratory tests. The following morning the physician arrived hurriedly. I was sitting up, in good spirits. Well, well, here you are, smiling and chatting as though you had no close call with death. He patted my hand gently. I hardly expected to find you alive, after I had discovered from the specimens that your disease was Asiatic cholera. You are fortunate, young man, to have a guru with divine healing powers. I am convinced of it. I agreed wholeheartedly. As the doctor was preparing to leave, Rajendra and Audi appeared at the door. The resentment in their faces changed into sympathy as they glanced at the physician and then at my somewhat wan countenance. We were angry when you didn't turn up as agreed at the Calcutta train. You have been sick?
Yes. I could not help laughing as my friends placed the luggage in the same corner it had occupied yesterday. I quoted, there was a ship that went to Spain. When it arrived, it came back again. Master entered the room. I permitted myself a convalescent's liberty, and captured his hand lovingly. Guruji, I said, from my 12th year on, I have made many unsuccessful attempts to reach the Himalayas. I am finally convinced that without your blessings the goddess Parvati, who are strong enough now to travel, I will accompany you to Kashmir. Sri Yukteswar informed me 2 days after my miraculous recovery from Asiatic cholera. That evening our party of six entrained for the north. Our first leisurely stop was at Simla, a queenly city resting on the throne of Himalayan hills. We strolled over the steep streets, admiring the magnificent views. English strawberries for sale, cried an old woman, squatting in a picturesque open marketplace. Master was curious about the strange little red fruits. He bought a basketful and offered it to Kanai and myself, who were nearby. I tasted one berry but spat it hastily on the ground. Sir, what a sour fruit! I could never like strawberries. My guru laughed. Oh, you will like them in America. At a dinner there,
Your hostess will serve them with sugar and cream. After she has mashed the berries with a fork, you will taste them and say, "What delicious strawberries." Then you will remember this day in Simla.